were not to be dissuaded. Among this group was Beatrice Massey, who in 1919 recorded her cross-country adventure both on and off the Lincoln Highway in a journal as her husband drove. She published their experiences in a book splendidly titled It Might Have Been Worse, A Motor Trip from Coast to Coast. In the final chapter, Massey advises other would-be Lincoln Highway travelers. You will get tired and your bones will cry out for a rest cure, but I promise you one thing. You will never be bored. No 2 days are the same, no 2 views similar, no 2 cups of coffee tasted alike. My advice to timid motorists is go. She made this declaration despite never completing the road trip herself. After covering more than 4,100 miles over 7 weeks on their looping journey beginning on the East Coast, the Masseys encountered terrain they deemed impassable around the Great Salt Lake. So they simply loaded their car onto a train and made the rest of the journey to the West Coast by rail. Once the country got rolling on road construction, not even the Great Depression could stop it. In fact, the dismal economy of the 1930s only encouraged it. With unemployment running as high as 25%, President Franklin D. Roosevelt viewed road building as an ideal way to put Americans back to work. Through passage of various New Deal emergency relief programs, FDR and Congress pumped a staggering $1 billion into road projects between 1933 and 1938. The spending spree funded the construction of 54,000 miles of improved roads. Just how improved they were, however, varied considerably. There simply weren't enough well-trained engineers and managers to supervise all the projects. In many cases, men were simply trucked off to work sites, handed shovels, and told to get going. The quality of the resulting roads was often correspondingly shoddy. Of course, anyone who has recently lost a rim to a pothole might suggest things haven't changed much. The Good Roads Movement began the push for better roads. Congress found ways to fund them, and Franklin Roosevelt made their construction a national priority. But it took the inimitable Thomas H. McDonald to get them built. McDonald, one of the more colorful characters in the history of American bureaucracy, was as fanatical about building paved roads as he was domineering, pedantic, and egotistical. As Earl Swift vividly described him in his book, The Big Roads, the untold story of the engineers, visionaries, and trailblazers who created the American superhighways, McDonald was the sort of man who insisted that his brothers and sisters called him Sir, his wife called him Mr. McDonald, all of his friends called him Chief. No one ever called him Tom. McDonald's mission in life was made clear to him while growing up in rural Iowa, where his family ran a lumber business. On countless journeys to haul their inventory to market, the youthful McDonald and his father fought an ongoing battle with the area's dreadful roads. Often, they spent as much time digging the wheels of their heavily loaded wagons out of waist-deep muck as they did advancing toward their destination. It drove McDonald crazy. So when the time came, he headed off to Iowa State College to improve matters by studying civil engineering. After graduating, McDonald took a job with the Iowa State Highway Commission. He quickly rose up the ranks and was named president of the American Association of State Highway Officials. By 1921, McDonald was appointed to head the U.S. Bureau of Public Roads. He was just 38 years old. McDonald ran the Bureau in the same heavy-handed manner that J. Edgar Hoover ran the FBI. Among his first actions was to demand a 30% raise. He made himself the focus of any meeting, controlling those around him with his icy stare. Subordinates learned never to speak unless McDonald addressed them first. One longtime assistant compared him to royalty, and he was often treated as such. Whenever he toured the country assessing potential new highway routes, town officials and business owners would fall over themselves to ply McDonald with the finest accommodations, food, and drink. This didn't go unnoticed. One enterprising individual impersonated McDonald on a visit to Blackwell, Oklahoma, and received the royal treatment typically bestowed on the chief. It was only after merchants tried to cash bad checks the man had written that they realized they had been played for suckers. Eventually, MacDonald even convinced Congress to give him personal authority to sign contracts. He'd reach agreements with states and simply hand the bill to the feds. But MacDonald's tyrannical approach and industry connections also made him incredibly effective in getting roads built. He was able to solicit support for road projects from dozens of key organizations, including the Portland Cement Association, American Automobile Association, and the American Road Builders Association. He rallied public support for projects with fanatical zeal, making the audacious argument that good roads were a human right, akin to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. MacDonald once wrote that, "Next to the education of the child, road building is the greatest public responsibility." Above all, he had the ability to steamroll projects through all opposition by sheer force of will. By his career's end in 1953, MacDonald had directed the construction of more than 3.5 million miles of paved highways. MacDonald also laid out the blueprint for the U.S. interstate highway system. In a 1939 report to Congress, Toll Roads and Free Roads, MacDonald and his assistant, Herbert Fairbank, set forth their ideas for the creation of an interregional system of toll-free superhighways. In part, the report was a response to President Roosevelt's favored plan that called for charging tolls. MacDonald argued that no driver would pay to drive on a toll road if a free road was nearby. He predicted the soon-to-be-completed Pennsylvania Turnpike would be a flop, attracting no more than 715 cars daily. No one is perfect. As part of his plan, MacDonald devised the numbering system for highways we still use today. East-west routes were assigned even numbers, and north-south routes were given odd numbers. The lowest numbers for north-south routes are in the western United States, and the lowest numbers for east-west routes are in the south. Later, beltways skirting large cities were given three-digit numbers that included the number of their associated interstate. Hence, I-495, the famous beltway around Washington, D.C., connects with I-95. Interchanges and exits were also assigned numbers, either in sequence or according to distance from a designated point. For drivers, the system offered a dramatic improvement over the previous patchwork of randomly chosen signs, numbers, and names. A final note on MacDonald. He ended his tenure at the Bureau of Public Roads as memorably as he ran it. By 1953, MacDonald was 71 years old, widowed 17 years, and had run the Bureau for 34 years under seven presidents. His brusque manner had made him bitter enemies all over Washington. Newly elected President Dwight D. Eisenhower, who had big plans for highways that would require a more cooperative approach, decided he needed fresh blood to lead the effort, and informed the chief that his appointment would not be renewed. MacDonald immediately returned to his office, summoned his longtime secretary, and told her, "Miss Fuller, I've just been fired, so we might as well get married." And they did, living out their remaining days in College Station, Texas. Just when it appeared that America was finally ready to begin building interstate highways in the early 1940s, the plan was sunk along with four U.S. Navy battleships when the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor. With the nation drawn into World War II, highway construction was put on hold. The war initially put the brakes on the interstates, but it ultimately helped accelerate their construction. The war effort pulled millions of men and women off farms and out of urban neighborhoods all over America. First, they were sent off for training at distant forts around the country. Then they were dispatched to fight across Europe and the South Pacific. For many, it was their first taste of travel and adventure. Except for the obvious drawbacks of armed conflict, most GIs decided they liked it. After the war ended and they returned home to start families, these former soldiers longed to see and experience new places, even if only in their own country. What's more, American factories that had been busy producing jeeps and airplanes for the military made an easy transition to making automobiles for consumers. It's hard to say if production inspired demand or vice versa, but car companies produced dramatically more cars each successive year following the war, from fewer than 1 million cars in 1945 to more than 9 million 10 years later. It added up to scores of eager motorists driving a record number of cars looking for new places to go and a faster way to get there. But when it came to building America's interstates, the war may have provided no bigger catalyst than Dwight D. Eisenhower. America's most famous general at the war's conclusion, Ike had become the country's president in 1952. He entered office with a healthy respect for roads. As a younger man, he'd made the treacherous journey across the Lincoln Highway as part of a famous highway-promoting military vehicle testing expedition, the 1919 Motor Transport Corps Convoy. And his experience directing America's armies only strengthened his belief in the value of good roads. In particular, he observed how Germany's thoughtfully planned and well-engineered Autobahn highway system allowed fast and easy transportation across the country. As the Cold War with the Soviet Union heated up, and the prospect grew that an atomic attack would focus on large cities, Eisenhower felt compelled to provide urbanites speedy evacuation routes. He'd also noted the obvious. Owing to post-war prosperity, the nation's roads were becoming flooded with automobiles, making congestion a headache for civilians, and raising doubts about whether the military would be able to maneuver through traffic in the event of war. Between 1945 and 1955, the number of cars on American roads doubled from 26 to 52 million. In 1954, Eisenhower presented his solution. At a meeting of state governors, Eisenhower's vice president, Richard Nixon, proposed a grand plan to create an articulated network of roads across America. It wasn't that Eisenhower was afraid to present the proposal himself. He sent Nixon because he was, sadly, attending the funeral of his sister-in-law. At the heart of his plan was a national system of interstate highways to enable safe, speedy, transcontinental travel and intercity communication. Ike argued that such a system would reduce congestion, increase economic efficiency, and improve the country's ability to meet the demands of catastrophe or defense should an atomic war come. The plan's estimated cost was as lofty as its goals. Eisenhower was proposing the most expensive peacetime project in history. Approval of the project would, of course, hinge on determining who would pay for it. State governors didn't want to contribute any more toward highways than they already were, and Eisenhower didn't want the project to add to the national debt. The dilemma reinforced one of the great maxims of road building. Everybody wants good roads, but nobody wants to pay for them. Eventually, Eisenhower conceded that because the project promoted national interests, the federal government should bear the brunt of the cost. The feds would pay 90% of the costs of the new superhighways, with most of the money coming from an increased tax on gas. With agreement reached on how to pay for the project, the Federal Aid Highway Act of 1956 was passed, providing for the construction and purchase of 41,000 miles of interstate highways. While many existing roads would be folded into the system, the vast majority of the highways would be brand new. These superhighways would be far superior to the narrow two-lane highways motorists were accustomed to. The new interstates would be specifically designed for high-speed driving, with the vast majority of the system's mileage offering four-lane divided highways and broad shoulders to accommodate breakdowns or pullovers. At-grade crossings would be eliminated, with intersections replaced by overpasses and underpasses to keep traffic moving in all directions. Access to the interstates would be limited to on-ramps in select locations. Finally, the new high-speed highways would be elevated well above the surrounding terrain to prevent flooding and promote quick drainage. America's superhighways were estimated to cost $30 billion and be completed in 1966. In what may be the single least surprising fact in this book, I must now inform you that the projections were a trifle off. I'll let Thomas L. Carnes deliver the grim details, as he summarizes so well in his book Asphalt and Politics, A History of the American Highway System. Land costs, inflation, and upgrading of standards forced Congress to amend the laws regularly after 1956 to raise more revenue. Taxes were increased in 1958, 1959, and 1961, pushing the interstate appropriation up to $41 billion. The Federal Aid Highway Act of 1968 added 1,500 miles to the interstate system. At the end of 1974, 36,500 miles were completed, and 2,800 more were under construction. The bicentennial date of 1976 became the new target date. That proved naive. In 1981, approximately 5% of the network was still unfinished, and the federal bill now exceeded $130 billion. Eisenhower and Congress didn't just miscalculate the cost of building the interstates. At the time of their construction, the interstate highways were engineered to last just 20 to 30 years. In other words, well before the last stretches of the interstates were completed, the first sections were already crumbling. If you've ever had the feeling that road construction never ends, you now know why. It doesn't. Today's road crews are engaged in a never-ending battle to patch and rebuild highways that have been falling apart since the late 1970s. When construction of the National Interstate Highway System finally concluded in the 1980s, America was a much different place. It was crisscrossed from coast to coast and north to south in ribbons of thick concrete, enough to form 700 mounds the size of Egypt's Giza Pyramid. It was also a fundamentally much smaller, more accessible country. Connected by smooth, multi-lane, high-speed expressways, America's distant ends didn't seem quite so distant. What's more, the land's treacherous mountain ranges, impenetrable swamps, and forbidding deserts no longer blocked the way in between. Suddenly, the Windy City was just a couple of days' drive from the Sunshine State. The hot springs of Arkansas lay just down the road from the snow-capped peaks of Colorado. A person could chow down a cheesesteak in Philly one day and a deep-dish pizza in Chicago the next. All that was required was a car and gas money. With the ability to explore more of their country than ever before, where did Americans want to go? Where would they stay along the way? And why did so many people suddenly have so much more time, money, and desire to take vacations than ever before? To learn the answers, we need to circle back just a bit. Chapter 3. Hey, where's everybody going? Americans set off to discover America. The early exploits of transcontinental drivers like Horatio Jackson and Charles Glidden had left a lasting impression on Americans. The completion of the Lincoln Highway and other major roads soon after made the prospect of exploring the country more enticing. And Henry Ford's Model T design made cars affordable, causing automobile ownership to explode. As America entered the 1920s, millions of motorists were ready to put the pedal to the metal. It was also during the boom years of the 1920s that Thomas the Chief McDonald began constructing highways in earnest. As new highways appeared, so did many businesses catering to motorists. Gas stations sprouted up almost overnight along well-traveled roads, giving drivers confidence they'd be able to refill their tanks when needed. Many of these gas stations also offered garages and mechanics ready to assist motorists with repairs. Farmers and merchants scrambled to set up roadside stands to hawk fresh produce and other goods. However, outside cities and tourist destinations, hotels were nowhere to be found. Unable to find shelter, traveling motorists brought their own. Auto camping became a national phenomenon. The concept worked just as the name implies. After a long day's driving, travelers simply pulled off the road wherever they chanced upon an inviting trout stream or farm field. Once parked, they'd pop a tent out of the trunk and pitch it right beside the road, or sprawl out in their back seat and fall asleep under the stars. One estimate indicated that by 1924, as many as 15 million Americans had tried auto camping. As author James J. Flink writes in The Automobile Age, an account of early American automobile culture, the auto-camping craze inspired an avalanche of tourists who never before had traveled more than a few miles from home to descend on distant national parks, forests, and points of historic interest. Of course, auto-camping was really just trespassing with a car. Property owners along highways quickly wearied of tin can tourists squatting on their land at night and squatting in their bushes in the morning, leaving behind all manner of waste. Soon, communities had to address the problem. Realizing that auto campers spent money in their towns on groceries and gas, many local officials decided that rather than drive off the trespassers, they'd instead provide a public place for them to camp nearby. These municipal-sponsored campsites typically featured a central pavilion with a fireplace, picnic tables, gas stoves, and pumps for drinking water. Some offered stands at which campers could rent tents and recreational equipment. By the mid-1920s, more than 5,000 municipal campsites dotted America's highways. Observing the success of the public campsites, private entrepreneurs speculated that money might be made offering travelers better accommodations. Soon, private cabin camps popped up alongside auto camps, featuring enclosed wood huts with bedding, electricity, heat, and kitchens. Typically arranged in a U or L shape around a central courtyard where guests parked, these collections of huts came to be known as motor courts. For a fee of $2 or $3 per night, motor courts offered travelers better accommodations than a campsite at rates hotels in the cities couldn't match. As competition increased, owners added one amenity after another and adopted catchy, or rather kitschy, names like You Like 'Em Cabins, Cozy Court, and Paradise Inn. Before long, motor courts were just a truckload of drywall, a case of Gideon's Bibles, and a tacky piece of neon or two from becoming full-fledged motels, a portmanteau combining motor and hotel. Technically, a motel is a lodging designed to allow travelers to park their car immediately outside their room's door. But just as all the elements of the American road trip experience were coming together, it would come to a crashing halt with the collapse of the stock market on October 29, 1929. The Great Depression had begun. Despite the bleak times, construction of new highways continued through the 1930s. In fact, the famed Route 66, the historic Mother Road that began in Chicago, snaked around the Grand Canyon and ended in Los Angeles, was largely built and completed during the 30s. Americans would also keep buying cars, only in far fewer numbers throughout the Depression. Midway through the malaise, there was still one car for every 1.5 adults in the United States. But it wouldn't be until after World War II that Americans got back to taking road trips. When they did get behind the wheel again, they'd never look back. It took a worldwide depression to hit the brakes on road trips and a world war to get them going again. The reason is simple. Money. People travel when they have it and not so much when they don't. With post-World War II America's economy booming as the world clamored for its products, more citizens were flush with cash than ever before. For nearly two decades after the war, America's economy grew at a stunning rate of 3.5% per year. With it, so did the incomes of American workers. By 1960, the typical American made nearly 1.5 times what he or she had in 1946. In real income, a factory worker in 1960 made as much as a plant manager just a decade before. What's more, between 1930 and 1960, the number of Americans considered middle class doubled. Americans weren't just doing better, they were doing significantly better. Much of the extra income Americans brought home was discretionary, meaning they could spend it on whatever they wanted. As it turned out, Americans wanted cars. By 1960, an astounding 77% of American families owned at least one car, a figure that rose throughout the decade. Beyond having more money in their pockets, Americans had more time on their hands. The growing influence of labor unions made the 40-hour work week common even before it was formally sanctioned by the Fair Labor Standards Act of 1938. As early as 1948, a Department of Labor report declared, paid vacation clauses are now a standard feature of union agreements in most industries. By 1957, 91% of blue-collar workers received up to 3 weeks of paid vacation. One more factor was fueling the post-war travel boom. Americans had been bitten by the travel bug. By one estimate, the U.S. Armed Forces collectively discharged 7 million soldiers in the 2 years following World War II. Many returned from conflict, not just as veteran soldiers, but also veteran travelers. When not in combat, they'd walked the romantic boulevards of Paris, admired the majestic cathedrals of Italy, and savored the crimson sunsets of the South Pacific. They'd seen much of the world, only to return home after the war with the realization that they hadn't seen much of their own country. Suddenly blessed with the means to do so, they were determined to take full advantage. And they wouldn't be traveling alone. Aside from delaying the plans of couples already headed down the aisle, the war made those of family-rearing age realize life was precious and fleeting. The time to settle down and begin a family was now. So the greatest generation set to work creating an even greater generation, at least in number. In the years leading up to the war, American women gave birth to around 2.5 million babies a year. In 1946, the first full year following the conflict, that number rose 40%. And couples were just getting started. Births continued to climb each year until 1957, when 4.3 million babies made their debut, a figure that wouldn't be exceeded for 50 years. Post-war Americans had fat wallets, new cars, paid time off from work, the curiosity to see new places, and lots of kids with whom to share the experience. One thing they didn't have was cheap air travel. That's not to say America didn't have planes. In fact, as a result of the technological improvements in airplanes spurred by the war, the aviation industry was thriving. All of the big four domestic airlines, American, United, Eastern, and TWA, were busy shuttling passengers around the country. The largest international airline, Pan American World Airways, began offering transatlantic passenger service as early as 1939, just 12 years after Charles Lindbergh made his historic solo crossing of the Atlantic. But flying still had its drawbacks. As travel editor Scott McCartney recounts in an article titled The Golden Age of Flight in the Wall Street Journal, the piston-driven planes of those days, like the Lockheed Constellation and Douglas DC-7, were noisy and ferociously bumpy. They couldn't fly over storms and turbulence the way jet-powered planes can. Engine failures were more frequent. So were crashes. And the cost of a ticket was affordable for only an elite few. McCartney points to the price of a round-trip coach ticket between New York and Los Angeles in 1958. $208. Around $1,761 in today's dollars. At such prices, most families were left grounded. Of course, if families really wanted to see America, there was no better view than at ground level anyway. What's more, automobile travel was cheap and flexible. The whole family could pile in and travel together for the cost of a few tanks of gas. Gas that in 1947 averaged around 23 cents per gallon, about a third the cost of a gallon of milk. Cars allowed families to leave when they wanted, and travel as they pleased. If mom lingered too long getting ready, the family wouldn't miss the flight. If one of the kids had to pee, dad simply pulled over. Best of all, cars afforded everyone the security of something familiar in unfamiliar places. In a way, you could drive anywhere without leaving behind the comforts of home. Car makers even sold several models as extensions of the family home. In one ad typical of the day, Ford billed its popular 1949 family sedan as a living room on wheels with seats that were sofa-wide. Could a built-in icebox and fireplace really be far behind? In the end, it wouldn't be a question of how families traveled, but how often and how far. The roads were open, and the cars were packed. American families were ready to hit the highways in unprecedented numbers. Halfway through the century, the golden age of family road trips was about to get underway. With Americans taking to the road in record numbers, Eisenhower's 1954 announcement of his grand plan of interstates couldn't have been timed any better. Newspapers and magazines were filled with articles touting the project. In a Better Homes and Gardens article from January 1956, writer Edward D. Fells, Jr. enthusiastically tells readers, "You'll be on one-way ribbons of highway so wide and safe, your whole family will feel free from strain and worry." It was as if the new interstates would be giant conveyor belts, effortlessly whisking cars from one side of the country to the other. All automobile occupants would have to do is relax and enjoy a carefree game of Parcheesi before arriving safely at their destination. The article's author went on to declare, without any apparent support, that while traveling on these magical new superhighways, your family is at least 4 times safer than on ordinary roads. Apparently, the new highways would be lined with inflatable bumpers like a bowling alley. Americans didn't need convincing. When the first sections of the interstates opened, cars veered onto the on-ramps in staggering numbers. Many were bound for distant vacation destinations. Where were they all going? Not just to sunny beaches, fancy resorts, or far-off theme parks. Many were on their way to places where families could savor America's natural beauty and connect with its historic past. Throughout the 1950s, and continuing into the mid-1970s, attendance in America's national parks and landmarks soared. In 1955, when the country's population hovered around 165 million, America's national parks collectively drew 62 million visitors. In just 5 years, the number would swell to 80 million. By 1972, that figure would more than double to an astounding 165 million visitors. Families also flocked to the nation's historic Civil War battlefields. Between 1954 and 1964, annual attendance at Pennsylvania's Gettysburg Battlefield tripled to more than 2.2 million visitors, about 13 times the number of soldiers who fought on both sides of the war's bloodiest battle. The nation's capital also became a popular destination, with families traveling, mostly by car, to Washington, D.C. from all over the country. In 1964, 700,000 more visitors climbed the stairs of the Washington Monument than just a decade earlier, and almost twice as many walked the halls of the White House. Finally, provided the means to cross the country's vast landscape, Americans also seemed intent on exploring their nation's rich heritage. Many tourists also followed the sage advice of famed New York Tribune editor Horace Greeley to go west. In the 1950s and 1960s, Americans developed a fascination with the Old West. Tales of cowboys and America's pioneer past dominated popular culture. Throughout the 1960s, moviegoers stampeded to theaters to see Western-themed pictures such as The Magnificent Seven, Once Upon a Time in the West, and Clint Eastwood's series of spaghetti westerns, so-called because while the films were set in the American West, they were produced and directed by Italians and filmed in the deserts of Italy and Spain. In 1960, 8 of the top 10 TV shows were westerns, including such classics as Gunsmoke, Wagon Train, and Rawhide. It's hard to say whether Americans' sudden interest in the Wild West was inspired by a pioneering spirit revived by construction of the new interstates, or vice versa. But the result was undeniable. The landmarks of the Old West became prime vacation destinations. Decaying boom towns like Virginia City, Nevada, and Tombstone, Arizona, boomed once again. Instead of gunslingers and prospectors, towns were now swarmed by camera-toting parents and kids with cap guns, often traveling great distances to walk their storied streets. Attendance also swelled, nearly to the breaking point, at national parks in the western United States. Yosemite in particular was overrun. Between 1954 and 1966, visitors to the park doubled to more than 2 million. The park's modest facilities and staff were often overwhelmed by hordes of guests expecting modern cafeterias, clean restrooms, and prompt service. In part, The surge in attendance was due to renewed interest in camping, another result of the Old West craze. But unlike the cowboys who inspired them, families of the 1960s didn't just spread out a bedroll and sleep under the stars. They hauled along gleaming Airstream trailers, complete with kitchenettes and comfortable sleeping quarters. Parking lots overflowed, and vehicles spilled out onto surrounding fields. Fearing irreparable damage to the natural environment, authorities tried to lure visitors to attractions outside the park, but with little success. Entrepreneurs were also quick to recognize the popularity of the cowboy fad, finding ways to bring a taste of the Old West to America's East, North, and South. Western-themed restaurants, hotels, and attractions sprang up alongside highways all over the country. The Bonanza chain of steakhouses made their debut in 1963, founded by Dan Blocker, the actor who played Gentle Giant Hoss Cartwright on the TV show of the same name. 2 years later, the Ponderosa chain staked its own claim in the market. The two chains would merge in 1997. Of course, hungry travelers also had their pick of any of a number of independent Wild West-themed diners and eateries bearing names like the Wagon Wheel, the Chuck Wagon, and Buffalo Bill's Restaurant. Afterward, they could retire to Mosey On Inn or Happy Trails Motor Lodge for a good night's rest, all without ever setting foot west of the Mississippi River. Interestingly, the first of the famous chain of Wigwam Village motels, which afforded travelers the opportunity to sleep in teepee-shaped concrete cabins, was built in 1935, well before the Western craze of the 1950s and 1960s. A handful of wigwams still remain today, most notably in the American Southwest and in Cave City, Kentucky near Mammoth Cave. While many off-the-beaten-track states had to adjust to the post-war tourist rush that new highways made possible, Florida had already been drawing vacationers for years, ever since someone had the good sense to put the state at the end of a major road. That someone was Carl Fisher, the same promotional whiz who organized construction of the Lincoln Highway. In 1913, at around the same time construction began on the highway that would link America from east to west, Fisher also started work on another ribbon of asphalt to connect the country from north to south. Leveraging his auto industry connections and promotional talents yet again, Fisher rallied support for a paved road stretching from his hometown of Indianapolis all the way to Miami. Extensions would later be added to funnel in travelers from Chicago and Michigan. It would come to be known as the Dixie Highway. Construction of the route moved considerably faster than for the Lincoln Highway, mainly because it folded in so many existing roads. Not even a year after breaking ground, Fisher himself would lead the inaugural auto caravan from his home city to Florida. He must have decided the warm Florida climate suited him. After his arrival, he didn't just set up a blanket and beach chair. He went to work building an entire beach community, starting with the beach itself. Fisher dredged Biscayne Bay for landfill to pile atop an existing barrier reef. On the new strip of land, he built a series of upscale resorts in hopes of attracting wealthy northerners. Borrowing the name of the nearest city he knew would be familiar to prospective buyers up north, Fisher called his new community Miami Beach. As a developer, Fisher profited handsomely from the Florida real estate boom of the early 1920s that his Dixie Highway helped initiate. Soon he amassed a fortune worth an estimated $100 million. But his luck wouldn't last. By 1925, Florida's hot real estate market began to cool. The following year, South Florida was devastated by a hurricane, severely damaging five of Fisher's hotels. What money Fisher didn't lose in the hurricane was swept away in the stock market collapse of 1929. By the mid-1930s, the once wealthy entrepreneur was destitute. He would live out his remaining years in a humble cottage in Miami Beach, the community he'd built literally from nothing, supporting himself doing odd jobs for old friends. Among his final accomplishments was helping to construct the famed Caribbean Club on Key Largo, a project he hoped would serve as a retreat for people who, like himself, had fallen on hard times. Despite his rise from grade school dropout to enterprising bike store owner to highway champion and wealthy entrepreneur, respected by presidents and common folk alike, Fisher ultimately deemed himself a failure. He died a broke and broken man in 1939. But his vision of Florida as a haven for sun-starved Yankee tourists would materialize beyond his wildest dreams. Throughout the 1920s and 1930s, droves of tourists trekked down Fisher's Dixie Highway to the Sunshine State. It wasn't just the elites that Fisher had hoped to attract. Scores of working-class motorists also made the journey in their sputtering tin Lizzies, as Ford's popular Model T came to be known. Others rumbled along in improvised house cars, the homemade forerunners of today's RVs. After arriving in Florida, they congregated in open spaces and set up enormous impromptu campgrounds. In time, they even formed themselves into a national club, calling themselves the Tin Can Tourists of the World, TCT. With each passing year, the most popular TCT campgrounds evolved beyond simply providing basic amenities. They also constructed elaborate wooden dance halls, clubhouses, and year-round recreational facilities. Many campers found the surroundings so appealing that they never returned home. A handful of these improvised communities, like Briny Breezes near Palm Springs, incorporated as towns. Others served as the foundations for major cities that sprang up around them, including Sarasota and Gainesville. Decades before the arrival of a certain white-gloved mouse, Florida was already drawing carloads of tourists to some of the country's first theme parks. In 1936, Cypress Gardens sprouted up near Winter Haven, initially as strictly a botanical garden. Its founders presumably hoped to attract a horde of horticultural-minded travel enthusiasts. 2 years later, Marineland made its debut on Florida's Atlantic coast near St. Augustine. Billed as the world's first oceanarium, the park drew more than 30,000 tourists on its opening day, shutting down Highway A1A. The main attraction that day? A single semi-trained bottlenose dolphin. A big reason Florida flourished as a destination following World War II was that so many American GIs had been stationed there during the war. As many as 2 million soldiers were either trained or based at 172 military facilities located across the state. Following America's entry into the war, it didn't take long for U.S. military leaders to realize the state's mild climate and vast expanses of vacant land were perfect for housing and training huge numbers of soldiers, especially pilots and air crews. Almost overnight, Florida became home to some of the largest military bases in the world, including Eglin Army Airfield near Pensacola and the Jacksonville Naval Air Station. At one point during the war, Camp Blanding, a major training center in the state's northern interior, was the fourth most populated city in Florida. Just as Uncle Sam introduced GIs to Florida during the war, many of these same men wanted to return afterward to show their families the sunny beaches they recalled so fondly. Tourism exploded across the state. Between 1950 and 1960, the number of tourists visiting Florida each year doubled to 10 million. By 1965, that figure escalated to 16 million. And just like the tin can tourists who came before them, many would decide to make Florida their home. During the 1950s, Florida's population increased 79%, by far the greatest state increase. Tourism would continue to boom in Florida throughout the 1960s because of the objects sent booming out of it. America's first manned rockets. After the Soviet Union successfully launched its Sputnik satellite in 1957, America instantly found itself in a space race, in which it was running a distant second. In response, President Eisenhower established the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, NASA, to kickstart America's space program. President Kennedy significantly upped the ante in 1962, when he declared that America would be the first country to put a man on the moon. Because of its ideal weather conditions, proximity to the equator, and the fact it had already long served as a missile test site, Florida's Cape Canaveral on the state's Atlantic coast was selected as NASA's primary rocket launch site. Cape Canaveral was renamed Cape Kennedy in 1963 by executive order of President Lyndon Johnson. He did so in response to a request by Jacqueline Kennedy, who felt the name change would be a fitting memorial to her husband, the president who had made America's space program a top priority. However, local Floridians never warmed to the change. In 1973, the Florida legislature restored the original 400-year-old name. As an alternative way to honor the fallen president, the NASA complex at Cape Canaveral was named the Kennedy Space Center. Today, the two names are used almost interchangeably. Throughout the 1960s, spectators traveled by the thousands to Cape Canaveral to witness each launch of NASA's Project Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo rocket programs. In the early days, even low-profile launches regularly drew crowds in the hundreds of thousands. Between launches, families could freely range about the Cape Canaveral complex on self-guided car tours. Though the gates were opened only on Sundays during a 3-hour time slot, more than 250,000 cars rolled through the site in 1964. In light of today's tight security restrictions, consider this. All of those vehicles were allowed to pass within yards of millions of gallons of rocket fuel inside the perimeter of a high-security government facility during the Cold War. When a formal visitor center, Spaceport USA, was opened in 1967, the attraction drew 500,000 visitors. 2 years later, it attracted more than 1 million. Attendance continued to swell every year, even after the Apollo rocket program ended. Without intending to, the U.S. government had created the fifth most popular tourist attraction in a state brimming with them. Cape Canaveral's popularity as a destination went stratospheric on July 16, 1969, when more than 1 million stargazers gathered on the Florida coast to watch Apollo 11 blast off on the first lunar landing mission. More than 60 million viewers worldwide also tuned in to watch it on TV. 4 days later, when Commander Neil Armstrong took his one small step to the lunar surface, America officially won the space race. Of course, Florida businesses had been winning all along. For nearly a decade, they'd reaped millions of dollars from throngs of hungry, tired, souvenir-seeking tourists streaming to the Space Coast to witness history. In 1970, 23 million visitors, more than the entire population of California at the time, made their way to Florida, mostly by highway. It was still a year before Walt Disney World opened its gates to hordes of Mouseketeers. For many families living in the eastern half of America, a road trip to the Sunshine State was becoming an annual tradition. It was indeed becoming a small world after all. While American families were just beginning to discover the appeal of Florida and the Old West, they'd been flocking to other diverting destinations since the days when there were barely roads to reach them. I'm speaking, of course, of America's many great amusement parks. New York's Coney Island began to draw visitors to its beaches as soon as a private company built a bridge to connect the small island with the mainland in 1829. As thousands of urbanites repeatedly fled the stress and smog of nearby Brooklyn to enjoy the rejuvenating charms of the resort area, a railway line and steamship service were added, cutting the half-day's journey to a mere 2 hours. Sensing an opportunity to make a buck, or thousands of bucks, a veteran showman, Paul Boynton, established an aquatic circus in 1895 to entertain visitors to the area. Boynton's show, featuring 40 trained sea lions, was an instant hit. Hoping to increase his take, Boynton quickly added a log flume ride and then a roller coaster featuring, amazingly for a pre-1900 ride, an inverted loop. Enclosing his attractions with a fence and charging a fixed admission fee, Boynton called his property Sea Lion Park. It was the first permanent amusement park in North America. Unfortunately for Boynton, he created a monster he couldn't control. The public's craving for new rides and attractions ramped up so quickly, that he couldn't keep up with demand. Investors with much deeper pockets poured into the area, setting up their own amusement parks and forcing Boynton to sell his park before being driven out of business altogether. Sea Lion Park became Luna Park, joining competing major amusement parks, Steeplechase Park and Dreamland, along with an assortment of independent attractions to form the largest amusement area in the United States. Between the early 1900s and World War II, Coney Island drew several million visitors each year. Interestingly, instead of bringing more guests to the area, the rise of the automobile actually helped drive families away. As the amusement parks of Coney Island grew more crowded following the war, street gangs began to exert an intimidating presence, especially in the midways, and the parks developed seedy reputations. Afforded the liberty of their own transportation, families living in the upper northeast increasingly opted to travel to the more appealing state parks of Long Island, especially Jones Beach Island, or take even longer road trips to more wholesome, albeit more distant, amusement parks. These included Rye Playland on Long Island Sound, Seabreeze in Rochester, New York, Riverside Park, now Six Flags New England, in Agawam, Massachusetts, and Lake Compounce in Bristol, Connecticut. The automobile helped amusement parks in other less densely populated areas of the country thrive as well. Founded in 1906 by chocolate scion Milton S. Hershey, Hershey Park remained a popular attraction, drawing visitors from all over the Midwest to the tiny town of Hershey, 15 miles outside Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Aside from the chance to tour the nearby Hershey Chocolate Factory, Hershey Park, renamed Hershey Park after transitioning to a theme park in 1971, invited guests to swim in several enormous pools and enjoy a merry-go-round, railroad, bumper cars, funhouse rides, and a roller coaster. On the shores of Lake Erie in Sandusky, Ohio, Cedar Point Park gradually transformed from a bathing resort into a full-fledged amusement park, boasting multiple roller coasters. Though it fell into disrepair during World War II, the park was revived and restored to its status as a major tourist attraction during the 1960s and 1970s. Meanwhile, across the country in Buena Park, California, a berry farmer was busy with his own budding attraction. In the 1920s, Walter Knott opened a simple roadside stand where he sold cartons of his berries, along with jars of preserves and homemade berry pies. Recognizing his customers were hungry for more, Knott encouraged his wife Cordelia to begin frying up chickens to serve as well. Mrs. Knott's delicious dinners proved even more popular. As word spread and more guests found their way to the farm, the Knotts built a proper restaurant, shops, and, to entertain the kids, a replica Old West ghost town. It turned out to be more like a boom town. After adding a steakhouse, saloon, stagecoach ride, and working railroad, the ghost town attracted its own following. And soon, Walter was installing a carousel, a mine ride, and a fence to surround it all so he could begin charging admission. By the 1970s, Knott's Berry Farm was a genuine amusement park, with sophisticated roller coasters and thrill rides rivaling those found anywhere. It's unsurprising that Walter Knott felt the need to keep expanding and adding bigger and better attractions. As of the mid-1950s, he faced stiff competition from another park that had opened just minutes down the road. Not only did the competitor have big ideas and substantial financial backing, the new rival was closely acquainted with one of the most recognized and beloved figures in the world. His name, of course, was Walt Disney. Referred to in early plans as Mickey Mouse Park, Disneyland was unveiled during a special event broadcast live on ABC television on July 17, 1955, hosted by Art Linkletter, Bob Cummings, and a faded movie star named Ronald Reagan. The enormous appeal of Disney and his animated characters, along with such original attractions as Jungle Cruise, Mr. Toad's Wild Ride, the King Arthur Carousel, and Snow White's Scary Adventures, soon had families traveling to Anaheim, California from all over the country, even beyond. During his 1959 trip to America, Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev had but two requests: to meet Hollywood legend John Wayne and to visit Disneyland. With Cold War tensions at a peak and security concerns high, Khrushchev's latter request was denied. Walt Disney's grand ambitions were constrained only by the limitations of his original land purchase. Just years after Disneyland's opening, it became clear to Disney that his 160-acre property was far too small to accommodate his plans for future expansion. What's more, Disney conducted surveys that showed just 5% of Disneyland's guests came from east of the Mississippi River, where 75% of the U.S. population lived at the time. As early as 1959, he began searching for a site for an even larger, more elaborate theme park. In fact, a complex of theme parks that would include a forward-thinking planned community that could serve as a test lab for innovative new ideas in urban living. This was the genesis of Epcot, Experimental Prototype Community of Tomorrow. Disney hoped Epcot would be a functioning city, where residents employed by the Magic Kingdom would live and interact with experimental products and technologies on a daily basis. Moving walkways would render cars unnecessary, and a green belt of parks would separate the city's public services from where residents lived. Only later, after Walt Disney's death, did plans for Epcot evolve into a more traditional theme park. After considering several locations, Disney settled on Central Florida for many of the same reasons the military had during World War II. Vast amounts of cheap land, a mild year-round climate, and a well-developed existing infrastructure of highways and airports. To avoid attracting the attention of land speculators who might drive up real estate prices, Disney formed an armada of dummy corporations to stealthily purchase more than 30,000 acres of land near Orlando, Florida. Finally, in October 1965, Disney's secret was revealed by an investigative reporter for the Orlando Sentinel. Walt Disney World opened on October 1, 1971. Unfortunately, Walt himself wouldn't live to see it. He developed lung cancer and died in 1966 at age 65. His brother, Roy O. Disney, would oversee construction. 3 months after the park's opening, Roy would also pass away. But together, the Disney brothers planned and built a complex of almost limitless imagination and appeal for children and parents alike. Today, the Walt Disney World Resort is the most visited vacation resort in the world, drawing a mind-boggling 52 million guests each year, far more than twice the present population of Florida. The opening of Walt Disney World was just one peak of a wild roller coaster of construction and expansion of amusement parks around the country during the mid-1960s and 1970s. The Six Flags chain of amusement parks began with a single property in Arlington, Texas in 1961. The Six Flags name refers to the six different nations that governed the Texas region over its long history, each commemorated with its own themed area in the original park. Spain, France, Mexico, the Republic of Texas, the Confederate States of America, and the United States. The company went on to build Six Flags over Georgia in 1967 and Six Flags over Mid-America, near St. Louis, in 1971, then acquired a series of independently operated parks, including Astro World in Houston, Texas, Great Adventure in Jackson, New Jersey, Magic Mountain in Valencia, California, and Marriott's Great America in Gurnee, Illinois. Near Cincinnati, Ohio, Kings Island Amusement Park opened in 1972 after buying and relocating most of the rides of Coney Island, a popular park that had borrowed the name of New York City's most famous attraction and was located on the nearby banks of the Ohio River that had become prone to flooding. Taft Broadcasting, the same company that built Kings Island, would also open Carowinds Amusement Park near Charlotte, North Carolina in 1973, and King's Dominion in Doswell, Virginia in 1975. Meanwhile, just a couple of hours' drive from Walt Disney World in Tampa, Busch Gardens in the 70s hoped to capitalize on Americans' rising interest in thrill rides by adding a few of its own. Once strictly a bird sanctuary and free-range habitat for African animals owned by the Anheuser-Busch Beer Company, Busch Gardens added a railroad, followed by one roller coaster after another, to broaden its appeal to families with children.